Utena Tenjo liked baseball. She liked to watch it. She liked to play it. She liked the unhurried pace of the game. It made for a good contrast with the furious hustle of basketball. Its tendency to provide players with opportunities for incredible heroism or spectacular failure, and the rather gladiatorial nature of the eternal pitcher-batter duel. She liked the way its statistics could be piled up over immense spans of time, providing a sense of history unparalleled in sports. Still, she was a little taken aback by this experience. She'd never seen the game presented on this sort of scale. 50,000 people packed the bright blue seats of the Raider Dome, nearly half of them fans of the opposing team. This was the first time in 40 years the World Series had been contested between two teams based on Earth, and the first time in 19 that the Boston Red Sox had been one of the teams present at all. Sox fans had driven, jetted, and ridden trains in droves to the shores of Lake Ontario. Hundreds stood around outside, plaintively repeating the age-old cry, "Need tickets!" The Art of Noise and its tech crew were in Section 115, Row 4, in the field-level grandstand along the first base line, about in line with the bag. Not spectacular seats, but good ones. The split between Sox and Raiders fans here was about the same as in the park overall, a little under 50-50. And there were some good-natured catcalls from the gray-capped Raiders fans at the Worcester squad's hastily purchased Sox caps as they took their seats in the middle of the row. Utena, wedged comfortably between Kate and Azalin, would have wondered bemusedly about the looks of rather glazed desperation on the faces of the Red Sox fans in the area, except that Kate, being one herself, had already explained the phenomenon in the course of one of their many conversations. It seemed that the Boston Red Sox hadn't won the World Series since the almost unfathomably distant year of 1918. There was a bit of a schism in Sox fandom after 2385, as to whether that really applied to the then-current format of the series, in which the winners of the Earth Series, American and National League champions, best of five, and the Galaxy Series, Galactic and Federated League champions, best of five, played each other in best of seven for the undisputed title of greatest baseball team in the galaxy. Hardliners claimed that the 2385 Earth Series, American versus National, was the real World Series, and since the Sox had won that series in that year before being flattened by the New Avalon Monarchs in the fake World Series, they had already broken their curse. The rest knew that, however many layers of abstraction might be introduced by the vagaries of galactic civilization intruding on the ancient rhythms of the game, the last series was the one that counted. And indeed, in 2386, the playoff structure had been changed so that the semifinal round went American Federated, National Galactic, to give ancient rivals in the AL and NL the chance to face each other again for the ultimate prize. The latter group of fans, by and large, were the ones here tonight, holding their breath, pinning all their hopes on the pitching arm of a 22-year-old Earthwoman named Consuelo Martinez, and the bat of a 30-year-old powerhouse from New Caledonia by the name of Jarvis McKeith. The Raiders, dazzling white and eye-catching crimson in their homestand uniforms, dashed out onto the field as the public address announcer gave them the sort of welcome usually reserved for descending saviors. Their fans cheered. Their non-fans applauded politely, for, rabid oppositionists or not, they recognized a fine baseball team when they saw one, and this was one. Taking the mound for the Raiders was their elder statesman, John the Silver Fox Gill, pushing 60, but still deadly. Tall, lean, and lanky, his craggy face locked in a perpetual scowl of concentration, he made his warm-up tosses as though impatient to have this done with. According to the blurb in the program book, Gill was an old-fashioned player. According to Amanda, this meant that he was a pre-Cambrian troglodyte, who was still upset about women having been allowed to play in the majors starting in 2010, never mind the whole Galactic League, Federated League thing. Utena glanced at Kate, saw that her entire attention span was riveted to the field, and smiled. There would be little conversation until this matter was decided. As it turned out, that was fine, because the game was a barn burner. The team struggled scorelessly into the seventh inning, The score held at nothing-nothing by brilliant pitching from both sides and some heart-stopping defensive plays. Both pitchers got into jams in the sixth, Gill with men at the corners and Coco Martinez managing to load the bases with a walk, a single, a hit batsman, and only one out. Both were extricated by a combination of their own good stuff. Boston's Frank Mizzucchi looked like he'd hurt himself, whiffing titanically on a 3-2 rocket from Gill for the second out, and utter selflessness on the part of their teammates. Joey Hermanito hanging himself agonizingly over the right field fence, just inboard of the foul pole, to utterly rob Mark Hoskins, tumbling down onto his face with the ball in his glove, and scrambling to his feet, ignoring the bleeding scrape on his forehead and the blood in his eyes, to fire an utterly perfect relay through shortstop Caldemar Orlandez that allowed catcher Josh Simpkins to render Alicia Stone meet at the plate, in the weirdest inning-ending double play Utena had ever seen. Amid all of this were the pleasant, and the unpleasant but somehow reassuringly familiar, rhythms of the ballpark, the cries of the vendors, the keenly incisive commentary of the fans. "Harris, you hit like my dear departed grandma!" was especially good. The beer relay to the guy at the other side of the section, the throwing of the pretzels and peanuts, the antics of the mascots. The peanut vendor for their section was a diminutive Asian gentleman with the most astoundingly deep and resonant voice Utena had ever heard, one that made Moose stand up and bow respectfully to its owner.
"Hey, peanuts, yeah."
The hot dogs were exquisite, the pretzels were so-so, and the bottled water was hard to screw up in the first place. The seventh inning stretch came, and Utena, to her immense embarrassment, Azalin's boundless glee, Kate's huge amusement, and resounding applause from all assembled, found her effort immortalized on the quarter-acre jumbotron overlooking left field. She was still scarlet when, in the bottom of the seventh, Martinez inadvertently balked a man to third on a botched pickoff, causing half of the people in the ballpark to turn quizzically to the other half for murmured explanations of the arcane and mysterious zen of the balk. Pitcher steps onto the rubber, sets, does anything with the ball other than throw it to home without stepping back off the rubber first. Umpire feels like bothering to call it. Balk. Runners advance. Many pitchers' pickoff throws to first base are really uncalled balks, especially for lefties. Both pitchers were tiring, starting to get a little sloppy, but their determination, good luck, and solid defensive backing prevented disaster for both teams straight through the eighth. By now, the Raiders fans in their section were saying that Toronto manager Jerry Castellan had to pull Gill. The guy was old. He was tired. He couldn't hack a complete game. It was stupid to try and give him one with this much on the line. But out the Silver Fox came, grim-faced and determined, to face Carl Harris, Boston's number 7 hitter. Well, the Raiderites comforted themselves. It is the bottom of Boston's order. They haven't done a damn thing all night. Why should they start now? Hell, if Jarvis McKeith, 365, 67 home runs, the hero of Game 6, had accomplished nothing whatever tonight, well, aside from some brilliant defensive work at first base, what chance did Carl Harris, 215, 6 home runs, have? Harris struck out swinging, smashing his bat in exasperation at himself for being so much of a sucker as to swing on an 0-2 pitch from Johnny Gill, of all people. Joey Hermanito fared little better. He ran the count full, struggling, fouling off half a dozen 3-2 efforts from Gill, but finally fell on a foul tip into the mid of Gill's battery mate Walter Herrera, and dragged himself back to the dugout in shame. The American League had eliminated the designated hitter in 2389, the year of Caitlin's birth. Sox manager Scott Santana, the Raiders fans opined, had to pull Martinez now. She was too young. She was tired. She couldn't hack a complete game. And it was stupid to try and give her one with this much on the line. Better to pull her for a good hitter and then replace him with the next pitcher. But there was no one up in the Boston bullpen. Ninth in the order for the Red Sox, with two out, nobody on, was still none other than Coco Martinez, a lifetime 148 hitter with 7 RBI in the entirety of the 2404 season. Half of the Red Sox fans present anticipated a miracle. The others anticipated extra innings, or, for the most pessimistic of the lot, ignominious defeat in the bottom of the inning. Martinez strode to the box as though completely unaware of the gravity of her situation, smiling a private sort of smile, her bat over her shoulder. With a rather conspiratorial grin for her opposite number, she dug into the batter's box. She was so slim her name almost didn't fit across the shoulders of her jersey, crowding in on the sides of her big red number 46. Gill regarded her with the hate-filled scowl he saved specifically for opposing pitchers, wound up, and delivered. In the sudden hush, the whap of the ball smacking into Herrera's glove was audible throughout the ballpark. Strike one. Martinez hadn't even moved. "Can I help you, miss?" asked one of the Raiders fans in Section 115. "No thanks," his seatmate replied. "Just looking." Martinez didn't seem perturbed. She just adjusted her stance, fiddled with her batting gloves a little, and waited for the next one. It came without delay. John Gill was not the sort of pitcher who screwed around on the mound trying to mess with his opposition's mind. He let his 102-mile-an-hour fastball and his frightful visage take care of that. He missed outside, then inside, brushing Martinez back to sprawl in the dirt with a pitch that made half the stadium gasp in outrage. Coco Martinez picked herself up, dusted herself off, and, grinning broadly, said something to Gill in Spanish. About a quarter of the fans within earshot laughed, and Gill's ears went bright pink. He scowled even deeper, set himself, and fired. Martinez strode, swung, and connected with a sweet, sharp crack that made Utena's heart skip a beat. She glanced at Kate, saw from the frozen gleam in her eyes that she'd heard exactly the same thing, and turned to watch. The ball soared lazily through the cool October air, arching above Gill's head. Mark Hoskins sprinted for the left field fence, crossed the warning track like he had a bus to catch, climbed like Spider-Man up to the 100-meter mark, extended himself until it looked like his arm would fly out of its socket and intercept the ball without him. The ball did end up in a glove, but the glove belonged to a man in a Red Sox cap sitting in the sixth row. The Raider Dome went berserk. Even the fans of the team that had just been scored against cheered. They had to. It was just too perfect a moment not to. Azalin looked like she was wanting to rush down onto the field, give Coco Martinez a hug, and tell her she was so cool, but Amanda had a solid grip on her belt. John Gill, purple with rage, struck out Frank Mizzucchi for the fourth time that night with extreme prejudice, but the damage was done. Still, all was not lost. After all, the Sox were the visiting team. The Raiders still had a chance to turn Martinez from hero to goat, and the Red Sox had lost with more. Out came Coco, tossing a ball up behind her back to fly over her shoulder and land in her glove as she jogged to her position, just like she always did. The Sox fans cheered wildly. Caitlin was getting hoarse. It was a good thing they'd played their show before coming to this game. Moose and the traitorous Peanuts guy, a transplanted Bostonian, as it turned out, boomed out an encouragement in stentorian two-part harmony, then shared a high five. Toronto cleanup woman Alicia Stone was first up. She had a very good record against Martinez in her career, 5-for-11, but Coco cruised past her with ease, punching her out on three straight sliders before squaring off against Walt Herrera, who she walked on four pitches. Red Sox Nation groaned in ancient, ineffable terror. Gary Alicea was next. He walked on six, and the groan came again, this time infused with a horrible sense of inevitable dread. Mary Ellen Jameson stood in, her face set in a scowl almost as foreboding as Gill's trademark grimace, and fouled off 7-3-2 offerings before leaning in too far and taking one on the shoulder. Red Sox Nation howled in outrage. Whatever happened to batters must make every effort to avoid being struck? Okay, said the Raiders fans. Now Castellan has got to pull Gill. Sure, the guy's the best hitting pitcher since Babe Ruth. Sure, he's batting .339 this year. Sure, they don't need him to go yard, just get a hit. Even a lousy bloop single could end this thing right now. But he's old. He's tired. He's sure as hell not going to pitch the 10th, right? Wrong. So here they were again. Consuelo Martinez versus John Gill. Gil's face said he hadn't forgiven Coco for whatever she'd said to him before that last pitch. Coco said she didn't give a sweet goddamn what John Gil chose to forgive. She set, stretched, and delivered. Gil looked contemptuously at a slider that missed on the outside corner, then gave his opponent a patronizing half-smile. Caitlin shifted uneasily, her fist clenched, knuckles white. Martinez nonchalantly accepted a new ball from the home plate umpire, tossed it up and down a couple of times, then stepped on the rubber, prepared herself, and threw. John Gil looked like he was waiting for a bus. He gave every appearance of a man stifling a yawn as the pitch missed high for ball two, then glanced lazily back over his shouldered bat at Josh Simpkins as the Sox catcher hurled the ball back to Martinez. "Look it up in your rule book," he'd said to a rookie teammate once when asked why he did things like that in the batter's box, under fucking with pitchers. There was a reason why Gil was one of the best hitters, pitcher or not, in the league, and it wasn't the strength of his arms. Coco Martinez scowled at the ball as though it had personally disappointed her, squared herself, and launched the next pitch. As sinkers go, it certainly sank, caroming off the plate and making Simpkins hurl himself at it like a hockey goaltender. It came within a hair's width of being either a passed ball or a wild pitch. No one could quite say for certain, but he got his chest protector on it, smothered it, and came up with it, glaring Herrera fiercely back to third. Gil made a remark of his own. Not many people in the stands caught it, but it made Josh Simpkins bolt to his feet, whipping the mask off his suddenly scarlet face. An instant later, before the plate umpire had a chance to admonish him, he got hold of himself and collected his equipment. The ump gave him a fresh ball, which he carried out to the mound. The crowd murmured uncomfortably as Scott Santana strode out to the mound as well, and the three of them stood there having a little conference. Martinez's dark-skinned face darkened further at something Santana said. She shook her head violently, making her black curls ripple in the lights where they escaped from her cap, and told him, in a voice that carried clearly to Section 115, "No fucking way, Scotty! I'm fucking pitching to this fucking guy!" Udina mentally crossed Coco off the candidates list for the Parenthood Magazine Role Model of the Week award, but found her own admiration for the pitcher increasing. Somehow Martinez talked Santana out of it, and he handed her the ball and went back to the dugout. "Stupid," said the Raiders fans. "The Fox is going to hang her out to dry, or at least walk in the tying run." Half of the Sox fans agreed. The other half sat on the edges of their seats and waited for the miracle. Consuelo Martinez returned to her place, towed the rubber, and settled herself in. Caitlin grabbed Utena's left hand in her right. Azalin seized her whole right arm. They all held their breath as the Dominican dynamo wound up and flung. This one Gil swung at, what the hell, 3-0, and connected with a very similar crack, launching the ball straight back up the middle. Sox fans screamed in agony, already picturing the rest, the ball streaking past Martinez, between Orlandez at short and Mary Reed at second, and dribbling into center field for exactly the kind of cheap, pathetic two-run single Gil needed to destroy their hopes and dreams for the 486th time. There was a sharp, percussive whap, and the cheering Raiders fans and screaming Sox fans all fell silent with a single, unified, confused, "Huh?" that nearly covered a second, softer slap of leather to leather. In the general area between second and first, Orlandez, Reed, and Jameson all looked at each other, puzzled. Gil stood at the plate, bat still in hand, a look of horror and shock dawning on his face. Consuelo Marietta Martinez stood on the left field side of the pitcher's mound in her follow-through position, facing first base, where Jarvis McKeith's long, burly body was extended in a perfect scoop, one foot on his base, closed glove raised in the air to make plain the force out on Mary Ellen Jameson, who still stood 4 feet to the second base side of the bag. A perfect 1-3 double play. A pitcher, Coco Martinez firmly believed, should be expected to field her position. "Tu madre, Juanito," she said to John Gil, and the Raider Dome exploded. Utena wasn't quite sure who kissed her, though she was pretty sure it was a member of her own party, and probably not Ein. At the time, it hadn't seemed to matter much. The IBGF went to Happy Seven again that night, perhaps more euphoric than the first, and rehashed the game endlessly among themselves. The restaurant staff and other patrons stopped by to listen enviously, complaining that they had been unable to get tickets, or trapped at work, or what have you. No one even seemed to mind that they were all Sox fans. This was pretty obvious, what with the hats, and the fact that they'd hit the Raiderdome's Pro Shops auto tailor on the way out of the stadium, and all had Consuelo Martinez jerseys on. They'd blown pretty much their whole payoff from the Sneaky D's gig on that, the food at the ballpark, and this meal, but not one of them felt that it was anything less than worth it. After that, it was back to the presidential suite at the Raiderdome Hotel for a contented night's sleep. This time, they were up in time for checkout and had enough bed space and towels for everybody, and with a free morning, looked through the guidebook in their hotel room for a couple of fun things to do before reluctantly giving up their grip on Toronto and returning to the academic grind. "Ooh," said Aslan, "take a look at this. There's a shoe museum in town." Amanda blinked. "A shoe museum?" "Yeah, see? The Bata Shoe Museum is the only museum to chronicle nearly 5 millennia of footwear development by the peoples and cultures of the planet Earth. That sounds really neat. I want to go see it." "A museum about shoes?" Amanda repeated, incredulous. "Devlin, is this true? You Earth people are so bereft of history that you must dedicate entire institutions to the preservation of your shoes?" "It does say it's the only one of its kind," Devlin replied. "It sounds like it could be interesting," Utina allowed. "After all, 5,000 years is a lot of history for anything." "Can we go, please?" asked Azalin. "This says it should only take an hour or two, and it'll be easy to get to. It's maybe 2 blocks from where we played last night." "I'll go if the rest of you insist on it," Amanda declared, "but I think the concept is ludicrous." "I owe you an apology, Azalin," said Amanda forthrightly as they emerged from the Bata Shoe Museum. "That was remarkably interesting. I had no idea footwear could have such relevance." "Told you," said Azalin. But then, to show that she wasn't going to rub it in any further, she turned the conversation to food. They had lunch at a pizza place near the museum, and then, since they had a little money left and Moose was feeling good, they went to the Ontario Science Center for the afternoon before finally aiming AON-1 back toward Niagara Falls. Passing through U.S. Customs was trivial compared to their entry into Canada. They pulled up to the booth at the Rainbow Bridge in the gathering dusk to be asked, "Citizenship?"
"Hoffman... Zeta Cygni, Zeta Cygni, Gamelon, Dantrov, UK, US, US."
"Any weapons?"
"No."
"Any fruits, meats, or vegetables?"
"No."
"Any individual purchases over $300 US?
"No."
"Okay." For a moment, Moose thought that non-committal-sounding response was just an approval of their lack of major purchases. Then he realized it was, in fact, a complete dismissal.
"Thanks," he said, and they were off.
Upstate New York in the dark was much like upstate New York in the daylight, except without as much glare off the bus windows. Utina bundled her jacket behind her and stretched out on the seat, folding her arms across her chest and settling her shoulders against the jacket with a contented grin. She glanced across the aisle to see Kate in a similar position against the opposite wall, looking back at her, smiling her quiet little smile.
Have fun?
She asked.
"Lots," Utina replied.
"Thanks for talking me into it."
You're welcome. I enjoyed having you along.
"We all did," said Azalin, popping up over the back of the seat in front of Utina's. "You're good to have around." Utina chuckled.
"Thanks. Say, whatever happened to your celebration? Wasn't yesterday a big holiday?"
"Oh, I got that done at the game," Azalin replied casually. Seeing Coco Martinez snag that comebacker and whip it to McKeith was definitely profound enough to qualify. She added with a grin.
Utna could see that, she supposed, but what about the, you know, meeting? Azalin made a gesture. Guidelines for that kind of thing are pretty vague and situational, she said. I could explain, but you have to have the right mindset for that kind of thing, and we've already determined that you don't. Although, actually, you took care of it for me this time. She grinned. You're a terrific kisser, by the way, she added, and then dropped back down into her own seat, leaving Utna to save her latest blush in private. Well, private except for Kate, who, Utna noticed as she glanced across the aisle, was regarding her with a mischievous little grin, gently enjoying her momentary discomfiture. Utna, caught by the grin, snickered, and the two of them laughed for several seconds before trailing off into quiet, smiling contemplation of each other. It wasn't the same as what went before. It wouldn't replace that. It wouldn't stop Utna from yearning for her old life and striving to get it back. But it was nice to have a friend this close again, all the same. With a little sigh, Utna settled back, closed her eyes, and fell into a contented sleep as the van's suspension swayed underneath her and the sweetness of Vivaldi underlaid the pleasant hum of her friends' hushed voices. After the curiously rushed feel of A-term, the fall sauntered past at a leisurely pace after Toronto. A-term ended uneventfully, and Utna and Kate spent the off-week between terms reading, playing games, and eating out without guilt since Daco was closed for the break. There was a quiet, unhurried ambiance to the campus during the breaks that made it a nicer place than usual to just walk around and breathe the cool fall air, watching the leaves turn. Still, Kate disappeared for 2 hours every afternoon. Still, Utna never quite got around to asking her where she was going or what she did there. They talked a lot more now, but somehow Utna's past still never managed to come up very much, except for occasional bits of anecdotes about schoolmates and funny situations. Kate didn't press. She was aware that such things required a moment, and that those moments were few and fragile, and she refused to jeopardize the pleasant new depth in their friendship by making a pest of herself. The IBGF and associates went trick-or-treating for Halloween, ignoring their schoolmates' disparaging comments on WPI.students that the students of a galactically renowned preparatory institute really ought to display more maturity. Liza Broadbank, who had gotten in Dutch with Student Council Treasurer Marcus Finch for burning $17 worth of fuel in the activities van on a night when she could have sworn she'd never left her room, was especially disgusted with the lot of them, which only increased their glee. Devlin, dressed in a cream and orange cricketer's costume, pinned a celery stalk to his lapel, and insisted on being addressed solely as Doctor for the duration of the evening. Amanda put on her full-dress Imperial Navy uniform, which Azalin, decked out in a ragged robe dress and carrying a spear as some obscure historical figure from Dantrov's past, protested wasn't dressing up in costume at all. Moose found a tremendous rusty black cassock, cowl, and scapular somewhere and became a Benedictine monk. Kate and Utna, stuck for ideas at the last minute, fiddled a bit with their hairstyles and dressed as each other, which Devlin thought was the single funniest thing he'd seen all year. Ed and Ein put in an appearance, decked out in razor-sharp black suits, sunglasses, and matching fedora hats. They were all a big hit at the annual Halloween dance, where most of the overly self-conscious society types, misguided snobs, most of them stupid, Amanda called them, just came in their grandest formal wear and put on silly little domino masks to satisfy the masquerade aspect of their invitations. The trick-or-treating session around the Institute's neighborhood afterward netted them a considerable amount of snack food, which was to serve them well in the traditional early November Deka quality plateau. The Art of Noise played several shows in Worcester and Boston, each quite successful, if not lucrative. Utna stopped counting the I'll take that last shirt lines at 47 in 3 shows, the second show having been at the MIT Student Union, which might explain the extremely high lame pickup rate of 12 per hour. Moose's axe became still further bitchin' with the addition of a new pickup Kate had designed, which, according to her, gave him 20% more blam to the ounce. Whatever that meant. The student orchestra's first concert of the year, the week before Thanksgiving, was a huge success. Fall turned slowly to winter, the temperatures dropped, and snow came in the weekend of Thanksgiving. After several days' experimentation, Utina decided that an ambient temperature of 20 degrees Fahrenheit or less, as measured by Kate's window thermometer, was brisk enough to make her wear her winter weight uniform, pants and all. Devlin Carter, amateur statistician, noticed that attendance in the three classes he and Utina shared diminished by 11% on days colder than 21 degrees thereafter. Life cruised along, heading pleasantly toward the holidays. Then, one night in the waning week of B-term, as a brisk December wind rattled their windows and moaned in the crevices of Morgan Hall's brickwork, Utina began making a new sound, also muffled, nearly denied, from her bunk. It took Kate several puzzled iterations to identify this new noise. It was coughing. Oh dear, thought Kate as she burrowed deeper into her covers. I must remember to stock us up on orange juice. The next morning, Utina emerged from her sheet-draped cocoon looking as though she had died in the night and just hadn't noticed it yet. Her usually clear skin was sallow, with dark pouches under her eyes, and the whites of those eyes had gone grayish and dull. She coughed, and when she wasn't coughing, she made a noise like a poorly tuned pipe organ. She stumbled to her wardrobe, opened it, made a grab for one of her jackets, missed, tried again, got it, then lost her grip and stood watching it with an expression that combined exasperation and a resigned expectation of oblivion as it slithered to the floor. Are you feeling all right? Kate asked, knowing the answer. Fine, Utina rasped. You look sick, Kate persisted. I'm fine, Utina repeated. I never get sick. As she spoke, she started getting a slightly alarmed look on her face, which was getting a bit greener the longer she remained upright, and beads of sweat jumped out on her forehead. Well, said Kate blandly as her roommate rushed for the wastebasket, you look sick. When she'd finished her business with the wastebasket for the moment, Utina looked back over her shoulder and asserted, I've never been sick a day in my life, and I'm not sick now. Ah, said Kate. Well, my mistake. Just puking in the trash can for fun, then.